into little containers and you're supposed to pour water through it and drink the water, that the radiation would make you nice and healthy instead of kill you. So there's a lot of toxic materials out there, some of which can cause mutations which can lead to cancers, yeah.
Question?
Yes, Brian?
A good point that was made by the other person that was just, I'm sorry I didn't get your call, but my father-in-law and my mother-in-law lived in the country, up in Orange County, and they lived not too far from a riverbank, but it was a clean stream, you know, from what we understand. And what's interesting about it is that my father-in-law, who is also a non-tobacco user, he developed polycythemia and eventually expired from that. So the question arises, is it possible that they could have had radon in their house and it never went detected because it was never, a detector was never put there? Could that have caused all of this?
Well, I mean, there's so many different causes for cancer that you kind of never know after the fact. Radon, you know, it's probably a more serious concern if you have a basement type of dwelling. If you have a house without a basement, chances are the stones that give off radon, radioactive gas, you wouldn't really be exposed that much to. But because basement apartments tend to be kind of carved into the ground, it's much more likely to have radon. But I mean, there's a lot of other things, unfortunately, in our environment that are mutagenic. So it may not have had anything to do with radon, but had something to do with benzene or something else that went, you know, boo in the night. You know, this again, it's a complicated situation, and there are so many possibilities out there that, you know, without proper testing, you can't really give a decent, reasonable answer on the subject. Could it have been? Yeah, it could have been. Was it? Probably not. Yes, Wesley?
Well, every isotope obeys the rules of inverse square law. So if we're talking about the distance between radon on the floor in its isotopic propagation to, let's say, height of the person walking in the basement. So usually it's not important, even though that you have radon in it.
Okay, but it's kind of a matter of tempting fate. You know, I mean, unless someone's exposed to toxic materials in high concentration, it doesn't usually kill people, it just weakens them. But, you know, every so often, some guy who theoretically should roll off of triggers a whole bunch of cascades, and you're screwed. So the bottom line is, how much do you want to tempt fate? You know, it could, you know, the odds could be 1 in 1,000, but, you know, if you start to roll the dice a couple of thousand times, eventually you're going to get snake eyes. So, you know, I'm sure there have been a large number of people with radon in their basements who succumb to extreme old age or succumb to heart disease or something else that had nothing to do with the radon. But, you know, in this life, if you can test for something and reduce your risks, even fractionally, a lot of people, a lot of times, will go with that.
Yeah, thank you very much for that explanation, Dr. Ray. I have a puzzle, if you have some time.
Okay, we'll see. David, you got anything else tonight, or that was that?
Hey,
yes, Jeff?
I was not prepared to ask a question right now.
Okay, David, I just wanted to make sure. I didn't want to take a, you know, to take your next, you know, question and bury it someplace. Jeff, you want to say something?
Hey, Stupiel. Yeah, Roy. I mean, we were talking earlier about some of the fundamental principles of chemistry and physics. About you worrying about people being educated about the Bohr atom model. I think we really, as a people, have to worry about people being educated about the fundamental biology and biochemistry and biophysics of causation of cancer before we commit a tremendous amount of money in the NIH, for example, to solving cancer. It's not going to happen, people.
Well, I mean, that kind of goes back to a very popular subject on the Middle of the Night, the repeater. Wesley and John, KC2WGB, may he rest in peace, used to endlessly discuss the American education system. And it, as far as I'm aware, it was never terribly good. I still remember that in elementary school I was taught short division before I was taught long division. And I was taught how the escape mechanism of skis worked in fourth grade. I was an expert in that for some strange reason, which I've yet to quite figure out. So, I mean, I think the entire educational system has to be rewired. I think at the very most, I think the problem is children are not really taught to think critically. They're just kind of given some subjects to sort of memorize or kind of understand. So, you know, I think it would be wonderful for at least the country, if not for the poor kids and the parents, if the schools actually taught critical thinking at the very beginning and then, you know, moved on from that to the sciences and economics. There are so many people, unfortunately, who don't have the faintest idea what economics is, who have an opinion about economics.
All we need to do is look at some of the threads and the comments and all that, and you'll see it, you know, people discuss it. And it comes from everywhere, but people focus on the United States because of, you know, biggest spenders or biggest voice or biggest populace. I don't know. I'm not biggest populace, that's for sure. Anyway, you know, my daughter's a...
Are you there, Jeff? We kind of lost you. Oh, well, I guess we lost Jeff for a moment. Hopefully he'll come back and finish that sentence. So I lost track. Brian, so you, that was your question for tonight, right? We're done with that? Curious, we got kind of silence. I hope nothing timed out on the repeater network.
Hey, Stupiel, I don't know. Maybe I don't know. I had a comment there, but if I didn't come through, then I'll pass it back to you. Hey, Stupiel.
Yeah, you just got to the point where you mentioned your daughter, and then we lost you.
Hey, Stupiel, it was just about the education system. And I stated that I wonder in advance that she was going to be taught things in a very, very simple manner and then learn the kind of more complicated system later on in advanced courses. And she thought that was a bit silly early on. And I've told all the educators around me that we should be exposing people to, kind of quantum way of thinking about things earlier on so that their mind can wrap around it more quickly later.
Well, I mean, fundamentally, I would agree with you. Practically, I don't know. The problem with quantum mechanics and even relativity is that they're certainly not intuitive. You know, human beings tend to kind of like to go with the intuitive easily explained type of concepts. And, you know, when you get to quantum mechanics, it becomes wave functions and probability, and it becomes very abstract. So in fundamentally, I agree with you. I would love to have been taught quantum mechanics in high school. I just don't know how easy that might be and how many people do you lose when you do that. I think educators kind of worry about losing people more than being more accurate with people. You know, the old concept of keep it simple. I think people are keeping it way too simple. I think we need to kind of grow up a little bit and make things a little bit more complicated. But, you know, the argument is in the degree of complications. You know, you start to write eigenfunctions on the blackboard and you've lost everyone.
Hey, thank you, Bill. Yeah, I agree, except the concept of quantization is very, very simple. It's that you have many very, very close, at the macroscopic level, you have many very, very closely spaced energy levels. So everything looks as if it's very smoothly happening when, in fact, it's actually quite quantized. So if you can say, you know, it's like a stop film or whatever, just introduce that concept so it's easier to handle later. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm sidetracking. Back to you, and I know Wes wants to go.
KG2RY.
Yes, David?
We were talking about cancer, and I remember looking on the internet, seeing these devices that allow for you to measure levels of radioactive energy, and one of them, two of them, three of them, a bunch of them I saw, they were talking about being able to measure these particles in the air, in the water, and in the food. You know, you could actually have radiation in the food.
Yeah, you can have radiation any place. I mean, unfortunately, you know, go out into the sunlight and you're going to get some gamma rays hitting you. You go up into an airplane and you're going to get even more gamma rays hitting you.
QSL. Thank you and have a great night, KG2RY.
Okay, likewise, David. Thank you for participating, as always. I do appreciate it. Wesley, I hope your puzzle is relatively short because we're kind of running out of time.
It is short. So, I was talking about models of an atom, and that was my question, why is being some outdated models are being taught in school, and actually, previous discussion, actually, was talking about education. But then I mentioned also the plane wave, one of the fundamental fundamental ways of explaining quantum mechanics. And then, actually, fundamental waves talking about the waves. Waves talking about the waves, right. So the plane wave is the study of electromagnetic waves, although it is two-dimensional and looks like a slice, but if you add the G vector, the time to it, then you have representation of tri-dimensional phase. So the phase propagation construct is real and positive, and the wave is traveling through Z directional, through the lossless media. So when we're talking about the propagation of the uniform plane wave in arbitrary direction, the question is, why we always use the G-axis as the axis representing direction of propagation, not the XY? Usually when you look at the Cartesian structure, you have XY sort of horizontal and the Z is going up. Back to you.
Well, I don't know. My answer would be that it was an arbitrary decision. There's nothing inherently requiring you to use the direction being Z. You could do the, it's just everyone has to kind of settle on an arbitrary choice. The three axes of Cartesian coordinates are equivalent. They're all just axes at right angles to each other. In three-dimensional space, you can have only three unique right angles that way. So you label them because we wanted to, X, Y, and Z. We could have done alpha, beta, and gamma, and we could have chose characteristics to tend to label things according to, you know, which of the three axes we want. So I think the ultimate answer, personally, is just arbitrary, the group had to settle on something consistent. Otherwise, if you use Z and I use X and the other guy uses Y, it makes something that's confusing even 10 times more confusing.
So when you're looking into it, so when you're looking at the fracture, then the XY is, instead of being horizontal, being placed vertical, right? And the Z-axis goes horizontal. So it's not exactly intuitive, right?
Well, again, as far as I'm aware, there's nothing in the law books that says that the X-axis has to be horizontal and the Y has to be vertical. It's just, it's just drawn that way, again, for the sake of consistency. If you start to move things around, what's important is the relative aspect of the three right angle axes, because it's three-dimensional space, so Cartesian coordinates are designed for three-dimensional space. If you were doing four- or five-dimensional space, Cartesian coordinates wouldn't be terribly useful to you. So, again, I think it's more arbitrary than anything else. You might draw a different conclusion, possibly, but that's mine.
Well, everywhere else, let's say mechanics, the XY axis for CNC machine, the milling machine, let's say, is XY is horizontal and Z is vertical, right? And then you have a few other axes. So it's like everybody says, okay, I know what you're talking about. But then you have a Z. So I accept your answer, but I'm going to give you my answer. But Chris, back to you.
Okay, you're free to have an opinion. You're not free to have your own facts, but you're free to have your own opinion.
With the XY, if you see the slices of the plane wave, they are vertical, and usually the direction of propagation is shown as the horizontal in Cartesian structure. So you cannot use any other letter because XY is... it's already used to define the plane. Back to you.
Okay, but it's not really, there's no kind of law that it has, that you have to define a plane by the variable X and Y. We just kind of decide to do that and do it consistently, again, not to add further confusion. You could use any variable label that you want for Cartesian axes. There's nothing inherent in requiring one to be X. It could be A, it could be Aleph, it could be, Gamma. It could be anything. These are arbitrary symbols. It's the same thing as any kind of a language. There's no particular law that requires the word the to exist. It simply is an agreed-upon use of language. So, again, I don't think there's something esoteric going on. I think it's just, it is arbitrary, as I mentioned earlier, that electrical current goes in the opposite direction of the electron flow in a circuit. You know, that's where they just got it wrong, but they kind of decided to kind of lock it in, and that's the way current's going to work from now on. So I don't think there's anything special about the label of axes in Cartesian coordinates.
Well, I believe it is because entry exchange. Any plane, unless it is an infinite plane, any plane is being described by X, Y, never by Z. At least, yeah, it could. But X, Y, right. So if you already reserved for plane, just for the people to understand, if you reserved X, Y, then the only one is left is Z back to you.
Yeah, but again, there's nothing special in that. Just people at the beginning of using Cartesian coordinates for geometries decided to use X and Y. Usually if you see a Cartesian coordinate in two dimensions, there's no Z component, and the Y is the vertical component, as opposed to in a three-dimensional demonstration, usually X and Y are on the same plane, and Z is the vertical. So again, I think it's you just kind of taking some arbitrary agreement among scientists and making it into something special that means something. Again, like current, to me, current should travel on the electron flow. That's what's moving. It's not ions. Ions are sitting quietly by themselves. It's just the fact that it was drawn that way and it was easier to go along with it. So again, it's just an arbitrary conclusion. You could just as easily call a plane YZ. The laws of science wouldn't break down. It's symmetrical across any kind of labeling of the Cartesian coordinates.
That's why we call them conventions.
Yes, other than in cases of handventions.
Yeah, usually if we were to follow the typical logic coming from classical physics, we would say, okay, if there is a plane and it's vertical, then it would be between Z and X or Z and Y. And at that point, we would at least have some sort of mental representation of that plane. And then the other vector, XZ, right? And then Y is the direction. So that would be kind of mental. Oh, everybody would think, okay, I know what you're talking about. But then they use XY for the vertical plane and the Z for the right direction. So, I understand what you're talking about. But that was the thing that I kind of caught my attention. Back to you.
Okay, but let's try a different way of phrasing it. Let's change the frame of reference. I mentioned before that relativity suggests that there is no inherent correct frame of reference. You get to choose any frame of reference you want. So I'm going to give you a frame of reference for a Cartesian coordinate system, outer space. Now, in terms of outer space, X, Y, and Z, are any of them horizontal? Are any of them vertical? And what the heck would that mean in outer space?
That one was strong, Dr. Roy. I have no answer that could contradict what you say. Because it has to have... Yeah, in outer space, you don't have a point of reference. Yes. You're right. Interesting.
Thank God.
Thank you, Jeff. I always appreciate your humor. Okay, so we all agree to agree. I think it's getting to 10:24, so I think you should kind of wrap this thing of yours up, Wes, and then I'll take it to Paul.
Comment.
Okay, Brian, we'll make it short.
Very short. I just wanted to thank you for your enlightening information tonight. Very, very well done and much appreciated.
Oh, you're welcome. I appreciate your appreciation. I try not to bore people. Sometimes I think I kind of talk blue sky, But, you know, there's time for blue sky and there's time for simple stuff, and I like to kind of do a little bit of everything. So I appreciate what you said. Thank you, Brian. Anyway, Wesley, you want to wrap it up?
Yeah, Dr. Roy, that was a good one. That was a good one. Really good one at the end of it. Thank you very much. Have a good one.
You're welcome. And there's no cover charge. Anyway, thanks to everyone who participated tonight. Please come back next Sunday when we'll try and do this all over again. And now it's time for the SpaceNet Report with Paul WS2N.
AC2GS WS2N. Okay, very good on all so far. Good net. And as far as the SpaceNet Report goes, it is quite a few topics that did happen this week. Might as well cover the one that made it to most news stations, and that's the Starship that SpaceX launched from Boca Chica, Texas. Successfully got off the ground, and that's the big rocket, one that's almost 400 feet long. And that's the one with the 33 engines in the first stage, and they all lit, and everybody was cheering there in their mission control in Hawthorne, California, and they successfully got up in the air about 3,000 miles an hour, and then they had the second stage separate from the first stage. And the second stage looked like it was doing good. It had nitrogen jets on it, turns it around 180 degrees, and then they fire some of the 33 engines ignite, and it starts heading back to Florida. Back to Texas, where it took off from. And then the idea is to come down and land successfully where it took off from. And that actually went very well. That booster came down, and they call it being caught by the chopstick, the two gigantic arms that are at the top of the launch tower. As the booster came down, the two arms closed. Grabbed a hold of the booster. You know, they have these aerodynamic steel deflectors that control it coming through the atmosphere. Those things are strong enough where these arms can grab it, and sure enough, that was successful. But probably about 30 seconds later, first stage is still on its way. The first stage was supposed to go all the way to, well, near the coast of Australia. It was supposed to come down vertically and land there. It didn't get that far. They looked at the telemetry and they realized that all the engines, seven engengs, six engines on that stage. You have three regular Raptor engines and then three vacuum engines. And sure enough, they all went off and it's supposed to keep going. And they wound up losing the telemetry on it, didn't know where it went, and it wasn't until later on that news reports came out that debris was seen over the Caicos Islands. You had people there with phones. It was still daylight or dusk, and they wound up taking pictures, and they said it had every color in the rainbow. Later on, I found out the FTS system terminated the flight when they realized they lost control of the vehicle. FTS is a flight termination system. Instead of
bombs really was inside the vehicle, designed to obliterate everything, you know, in case they lose control. So that's what happened. And SpaceX gives it the name Rapid Unscheduled Disassembly, which, by the way, they stole that name from NASA from decades ago. So, you know, they looked into what could have gone wrong. That's what they're investigating now. The federal government is not going to allow them to take off again until an investigation is done. And they'll look into it before they can launch number 8. This was number 7, and you know they've lost quite a few of these things in the beginning when they were launching. The goal is to eventually get to orbit. And he hasn't even had a plan. When I say he, Elon Musk with SpaceX hasn't even had a plan to get to orbit. He's looking to fly these massive rockets one after the other and learn from each flight until they get better at it, and then they plan on getting to orbit. So that's a problem. That was the main story that the news covered, but also another flight took off. The same day, 1 o'clock in the morning. What happened was the Blue Origin company had a launch at 1 o'clock in the morning. Well, actually, it went off a little late, around two o'clock in the morning. The same day. This all happened on Thursday, by the way. And they have a heavy lift rocket. If you were to lay the rocket down on a football field, it would be that whole length, over 300 yards, over 300 feet, over 100 yards. And sure enough, that did take off. They launched this thing for years. Many years of development, and they had some delays. They thought they would get it off the launch pad in October, and they finally settled on January. But they did have a couple of delays. They kept shifting it, a day or two. But they finally got it off the ground on Thursday. The big deal with this rocket, by the way, it's called the New Glenn, is that on the very first try, they put it into orbit. The first stage successfully was launched. It had seven engines on the first stage. They're bigger engines than what SpaceX has, and these are called BE-4 engines. So the seven engines ignited at almost 4 million pounds of thrust and got the whole vehicle off the launch pad and started heading a 30-degree inclination away from Florida. And sure enough, they separated the second stage from the first stage. First stage ignited. They have a completely different system than what SpaceX has. SpaceX is using all methane for the first stage and second stage, where Blue Origin is using methane. They call it LNG, which is very similar to methane. It's a slight difference, but anyway, that's what they use for their first stage, with liquid oxygen. Second stage, completely different. They use liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen for the second stage. They have the two BE-3 engines, they call them. The whole thing is like 320,000 pounds of thrust, so even much more powerful than the SpaceX second stage. Essentially, this rocket is massive. It has a 7-story tall fairing. The diameter of that is
23 feet in diameter. So you could put a probably a small house inside this thing. So anyway, that second stage did make it to orbit. In fact, they put it on a high inclination orbit, going out around 12,000 miles away from Earth, coming back down, and going about 1,000 miles or so on the closest approach to Earth. You know, at perigee, apogee is around 12,000. So that was the history. The first rocket of any kind, you know, large rocket, but on the first try, they made it to orbit. So we'll see how Blue Origin does. The second stage made it to orbit. The first stage on Blue Origin was supposed to be caught by a drone ship out at sea. That came down. They lost telemetry on that as it was coming down. So they have to work on that. Jeff Bezos, in charge of Blue Origin, really wasn't really counting on landing it. If it did land, they would have been extremely happy. Their goal was to make it to orbit. And by the way, NASA, once they get involved with Blue Origin, they really they're not interested in whether or not they land that second stage or not. Their goal is to put the payload into orbit. So if it was a NASA payload, NASA would have been very happy. It's considered a successful flight. Anyway, any comments on these two rocket vehicles that actually went up on the same day? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report.
This is Kilo Foxtrot 2-2-2 with a comment.
Okay, fine business. Brian, right?
That's correct. Yes. So my question is on the what's the name of it that Musk has, the Starship. Why did they explode using the FTS rather than have the vehicle just come down in an area that could have been retrieved as a whole, or was that just not possible? Or did the actual section explode on its own without the FTS?
The report I read was the FTS was initial. Well, you could either light that off from the ground or it'll do it automatically. I guess it went off automatically. You could also shut it down at a point. You could shut it down early. Now, I listened to this one guy, Scott Manley. He does these YouTubes, and I find him very reliable. I've been listening to him quite a few years. And he more or less basically said the same thing as you, Brian. Maybe next time around they should make it where the FTS is shut off a little early, and this way that the whole contraption could have come down in one shot. Maybe that would have been better off instead of coming down in millions of pieces. So I don't know. There's a vote for you, Brian. Back to you.
Hey, CTP. So I don't know how they're going to find the root cause if the spacecraft is destroyed.
Yeah, I believe they will. They have hundreds and hundreds of sensors all over these things, and that's how they get, you know, they get their information back through the telemetry right up until the very end. Especially with this thing, they're using the Starlink satellites that SpaceX has up there, and they're constantly transmitting from all their hundreds of sensors and cameras. They have over 30 cameras mounted on this rocket, and they're all transmitting at the same time. And because of the bandwidth that the Starlink is operating on, they will be able to get all the information back. I believe they'll find the exact root cause. They have already come out with a possible oxygen leak in the the first stage above where the engines are. Where some of the piping is. They have a lot of insulation between the rocket stages and the piping, and they've already come up with that theory where that's where the problem began. So we'll see. Now there was another station. Go ahead, WS2N.
Okay, Paul, AC2PL, Jeff. I'm assuming that they blow the thing up at the first sign of trouble in order to make sure that they don't land a Volkswagen on top of someone's house, right?
Yeah, right. They've been doing this for decades. Anything that goes up in Florida, Boca Chica, Texas, Vandenberg Air Force Base, California, Wallops Island, you've got rockets going off there. You got, now you have the Electron being launched from there with the Antares rocket as soon as go back on Wallops Island. You know, when they launch, they all have the FTS, and that's what happened. In fact, they had one. They had launched an Antares rocket. 2014 from Wallops Island, and it didn't make it too far. It had the NK-33 engine, one of the NK-33 engines blow, and that triggers the FTS as well. And that debris, that came down on a launch pad, destroyed a lot of infrastructure. So, very good. Back to you, Jeff.
Yeah, Roger, just hoping that everything they put up there comes down in an organized fashion or semi-disorganized fashion, as it were. Comment?
Yeah, and years ago, on the Apollo launches, there was a long wire on the outside of it. That's how they did it from the top all the way down. And so if that wire broke apart for any reason, when it wasn't supposed to, that would set it off. Another comment, go ahead.
This is Brian, KF2ZZ. What I'm curious about is why would they initiate the destruction sequence over the Turks and Caicos Islands or within that path rather than letting the rocket pass into an uninhabited area into the ocean? Because now you have a lot of debris, from what I understand, on the Turks and Caicos Islands that Mr. Musk is going to have to clean up.
It was initiated automatically, he said so.
Yeah, QSL. And by the way, it blew up over the Bahamas and long distance from there to the Turks Caicos Islands. So going at that speed, that's what happens. When it first when I first lost contact with the thing, I thought it was going to make it all the way, like, possibly crash into Africa. They're supposed to go over Africa, eventually over to Australia. I found out that this thing blew early. That's not too good. I mean, it just got over the Gulf of Mexico and not too far after that. He's got a lot of work to do. I don't know about regulations and all that. I think that could all very easily change with the new administration. We'll see. Anybody that's under this thing should keep looking up until they perfect it, that's for sure.
What they should have done was have the ability to calculate the altitude and speed and then detonate over the water, you know, and approximate it so it was past any habitable areas.
Well, I don't know. You know, they probably, once they lose control, once this thing loses control, they want to blow it up. I mean, anything could happen. They don't want this thing coming, you know, going off, you know, in the northerly direction or in the southerly direction, you know, areas that they haven't even figured on and blowing up over there. There's going to be an investigation, and I'm sure there's going to have to be some changes. The airplanes that were in the area were told, you know, back off, you know. In fact, some airplanes that were already low on fuel, you know, they do that, you know, when a plane flies from one place to another, they don't necessarily load the whole thing up with fuel. You know, sometimes they'll run light. But some of those planes, they were directed to land where they weren't supposed to land. So there were a lot of changes. They didn't want this debris coming down and hitting a plane.
Yeah, there was a lot of shrapnel, basically, that landed on Turks and Caicos, from what I had seen. Anyway, thank you very much.
Okay, fine business. Yeah, and I'm sure most people have seen this. The beautiful colors coming up in the sky. They said because the sun was going down, you know, you were able to get the different colors, blues and reds. You know, not good. I think that vehicle is almost 200 feet long. You know, with seven very well-built, sturdy Raptor engines. I can't believe that those engines, or parts of those engines, didn't make it all the way down to the ground. You know, everything doesn't, you know, turn to smoke when you have those kind of engines. I mean, if those engines are actually being built to withstand many, many relights. In fact, many, many reuses. I mean, the idea is to eventually bring the Starship down as, you know, they call it the ship at the second stage, as well as the booster, and reusing everything. I mean, that's the plan. So these engines are, you know, I'm sure, very well built. You know, I can't, you know, I hope some of them, most of it wound up in the water. But it looks like some of the stuff hit land. And I heard no injuries. Anyway, I just wanted to go on to an EVA that took place on the International Space Station. That was with astronauts Nick Hague and Sonny Williams. By the way, Sonny Williams' call letters. KD5PLB, and she's been up there a long time. June 5th, she went up with Butch Wilmore, and they're the ones that they write about that are supposedly stranded on the International Space Station. So they're quite comfortable up there. They're living in it's equivalent to a 15-room building flying in space. So there's plenty of food, plenty of clothes. People have lived up there 6 months at a time. Some people have lived up there for a year or more at a time. So there's no problem. I mean, they weren't scheduled to do that. They were scheduled to come back in 8 days. Well, they thought maybe 14 days, you know, 2 weeks. But because they went up in the Starliner, that NASA deemed it was unsafe to come back in,
because of the thruster problems. They said, well, they could stay up there. SpaceX will send up a... they're going to send up a crew of four anyway. We'll just make it a crew of two, and then when it's time to come back 6 months from now, you'll all come back together, all four. And that's the plan. They were supposed to come back in February, but they have delayed that another month because SpaceX is building another Dragon crew vehicle that's just not ready yet. So they'll be up there another month. We'll see them back in March. But anyway, they did a very good EVA. They did four main things they needed to do. They needed to change out a gyro assembly. International Space Station has these massive gyros that spin. And you could actually change the rotation of the space station. You know, move it one way or the other. By the way, these gyros spin. They're all set at 90 degrees from one another. With this, four of them, they only need like three to operate. Anyway, one of the they have a gyro assembly that controls one of these things. It needed to be changed out. They did that. And then they installed little patches on one of the telescopes that's attached to the International Space Station. It's called MISA, Neutron Star Interior Composition Explorer. This box thing that accepts X-rays flying through space. So let's say a neutron star blows up somewhere, and X-rays are flying through space, and it somehow reaches the International Space Station. This thing is designed to pick it up, and it could pick up, all kinds of different events, black holes blowing up, or something like that. That's what it's designed for. But it needs to have these optical sensors completely dark. Turns out one of the two corners of the this nicer box, apparently light is getting in, which is fouling things up. So they were able to install some kind of patches or covers for the light filters for the X-ray telescope, and that was successful. The third thing that they did was they worked on a reflector that will be used for incoming spacecraft that are going to be docking with the space station. The American side has four different places where spacecraft can attach if they're coming up. Two for docking, two for berthing, and one of them is on the Harmony module. We call it Node 2. Anyway, it's the Harmony module. That's the one, the most forward module on the whole setup. Like I said, there's like 15 of these things all over the place. Not all in line, of course, but the one that's most forward is called Harmony, and that accepts two visiting spacecraft to dock with the Harmony module. One in, through the forward port as you're coming up. And then one at the zenith point, that's one on top. And there's a top and bottom on the International Space Station. As the space station goes around the Earth every 90 minutes, the space station actually rotates as it goes that whole time. So actually the whole space station is actually doing one turn every 90 minutes. The nadir, or the bottom part of the space station, is always facing toward the Earth. And that's the way it works.
Anyway, that worked out okay. And this is, by the way, this is all in a 6-hour EVA, and worked out to exactly 6 hours to the second. The other let's call it telescope that they worked on was the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. That thing's been up there a long time since 2011. It was sent up on the very last shuttle mission, and the robotic arm had installed this thing way back then. And since then, it's been worked on. It's been upgraded by other astronauts on EVAs. Now they plan on upgrading it again. So they needed to do some preliminary work there, cutting some insulation away, cutting some ties that hold all the tubing together, and that was successfully done. So with that, a lot of pictures that they had to take. That was a successful EVA. They returned back into the Quest module, and that's where they were able to get their suits off and come back into the International Space Station. And they will be doing another EVA very shortly. And in fact, Sonny, over the call letter KD5PLB, will be doing another spacewalk, but not with Nick Hague. She'll be going out with the fellow that she went up on Starliner with, Butch Wilmore. So we'll see how that one goes. That should be another interesting spacewalk as well. And that won't be until, I think, another couple of few days. January 23rd. So we'll see. I'll report on that when that happens. This is WSUN. Any other comments?
K2 DFA. I have a question. How did you find out of this about the space station?
I know a lot about the station. Space station. Are you talking about the information about the different locations where you dock vehicles to, or are you talking about, you know, all the different modules that they have? You know, I've been following it, like, forever. But anything specific?
I was just wondering how you knew, like, about everything in general. Like, I didn't know if you, like, worked for NASA, and then, like, just hoped that they offer someone to answer the radio questions. I don't know.
Yeah, I wish. I'm retired, but we had some contracts, and a couple of contracts were over at Grumman, and, you know, we were an outside contractor, so but I got to see a lot of stuff that they had there. That's about as close as I got to anything like that, but I've just been following my whole life, and been doing the SpaceNet report for, you know, I have a number, 600, since I've been keeping track, 622 at different weeks. That's the deal on that. And if you ever want to, yeah, well, there's plenty of places you can go to on the internet to look and, you know, see what the space station is about, the construction of it and all. I'm a member of LIMOC, of course, and
that time
a couple of years ago I did a presentation for them, you know, which involved talking about the construction of the International Space Station, you know, from the beginning until now. And also how amateur radio related to it, you know, where the shacks are, that's what we call them, the shacks, where they transmit from on the International Space Station. You know, all of that was included. And
Limog keeps a whole load of YouTubes, you know, and kind somebody does a presentation, they record it, and it becomes one of the YouTubes. You can see my YouTube, actually, if you go to the Limog.org website, and you go to the YouTube section, and you can scan through a bunch of these YouTubes that they have, and you can see the